Hello friends, I'm continuing with this method where I'm not wearing my usual gear, and hopefully everything is loud and clear. We had reached the beginning of Rule 8 in A Treatise on White Magic, these video commentaries, and so this is really commentary number 8, actually, in this series. Now there are on Makara, www.makara.us, 50 other programs on white magic preceding these that I'm doing, and they are on the introduction and on the rules for magic on the mental plane, the 6 rules. Now we're working on the 5 rules of magic for the emotional plane, and we're on really the second of those rules, which is Rule 8. And whether this program will be, an hour or a half hour, will depend upon various other demands upon my time. But it will be at least a half hour. Okay. So we've read Rule 7, just catching up with that. The dual forces of the plane upon which the vital power must be sought are seen. The two paths face the solar angel. The poles vibrate. A choice confronts the one who meditates. Now we'll get into, and I think I've, done to the best of my present ability, explain my perspective on that. All I can offer is my own perspective, without claiming that it is necessarily correct in all particulars. It probably is somewhat correct. But in all particulars, I would be very hesitant to say that I had achieved that. One day, one fine day for all of us. Now, Rule 8, the Agnisurians respond to the sound. The waters ebb and flow. Let the magician guard himself from drowning at the point where land and water meet. The midway spot, which is neither dry nor wet, must provide the standing place whereon his feet are set. When water, land, and air meet, there is the place for magic to be wrought. Well, deeply symbolic phrases, pictorial language, but all of it conveying inner happenings and attitudes and points of focus and timing. We'll get into that. Why should it be when water, land, and air meet instead of where water, land, and air meet? And what is the difference between the point where land and water meet and this other midway spot where there is land and water, but air as well, symbol of etheric energy in this case. So we will proceed and look at these types of astral force and the cyclic ebb and flow. We realize, what a work Master DK has undertaken here, and how well organized all this is for our assimilation. And I must say, he said, well, it will serve you for, the coming generation of occult students, but what is a generation? When I look at this material, I see it, like the secret doctrine, serving for probably hundreds of years. So what does he mean by a generation? Anyway, all of that is to be solved by us as we go along. Types of astral force. It would be advisable for the student to read with care. Is always the case. He says you don't read carefully enough. to read with care the commentary on this rule as given in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. Now, I actually have worked on that. And when I went through A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, most of it with written commentary, I included some of the white magic commentary. So the two are occurring side by side, and in fact, they do emphasize different things. He's really not repeating himself. It will be noted how extremely abstruse it is, and how full of almost blind occult information. I must say, you know, he seems to do a different thing here in White Magic. We remember that Treatise on Cosmic Fire is written for initiates. And by that, I'm sure he means, you know, initiates of at least the third degree. But A Treatise on White Magic is not. And he elaborates more fully and in language which is not so terse and impenetrable and occult. The interpretation of some of the things found, a fuller interpretation of some of the things found in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. So, it's extremely abstruse. I found it that way when I was trying to say something about it. All you can do is really try to say something about these things and pull out your reasoning power and your memory and your intuition when that is possible and offer what dawns upon you. Other things will dawn upon other people. And in the collection of all those dawnings or revelations will come increased illumination. Anyway, this should be studied, this relatively short section on A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, the section on magic. It should, however, be studied. The word astral plane should also be looked up and a general idea gained as to its nature and its function as the battleground of the senses. I suppose there are astral senses as well as, you know, the normal five more material senses, the higher correspondences of these senses, but how will the senses in the dense physical planes be used according to our desires? So how will the dense physical senses be used according, let's say, to the nature of our desires? The battleground of the senses, and as the place where magic is wrought. Well, let's just say in this way, magic seems to be wrought in relation to a number of planes and subplanes, but there is much on the astral plane which needs to be cleared up, probably through the magical process. The intelligent and constructive desire of the white magician, acting under the instruction of his own soul, and therefore occupied with group work, is the motivating power back of all magical phenomena, especially, especially the phenomena associated with the white magical process, the white magical process. It's constructive, it's in line with the plan, it seeks to mobilize the energies and forces of the lower world so they adhere to the design of the plan. And then, you know, instruction from our own soul when we're in alignment. What is that current of energy which reveals to us the right way to go in various situations and when we are confronted by choice? And do we consult with that stream of energy? Do we feel it? Do we feel the presence of the solar angel projecting itself into our causal body, egoic lotus, and substanding that structure and functioning as the angel of the presence, which eventually introduces us to the presence which we are? Are these just words, or do we have the experience? So everyone has to figure that out and go for the experience rather than be happy with the manipulation of words. You know, having spent a lot of time, I have a lot of third ray, dealing with the manipulation of words, I certainly realize the insufficiency of that particular approach. So align with the higher part of oneself, and we're shown that that does indeed, you know, happen. Let's see if I can. I was just doing a little research on Easter Island, amazing Lemuro Atlantean relics, amazing. But let's just see if I can get into. Okay. So, see if I can get into that. These are diagrams from Tuya. They are new diagrams, and they're really wonderful. She's spent a lot of time and care with the color schemes and so forth. And of course, you know, before that, Keith Bailey did a lot of work on similar things. And it's all been very constructive. So where are we here? Okay, the battleground. Instruction from one's own soul. And you notice the line here from the mental unit, seemingly to the very center of soul life, which is the attenuated consciousness extended or projected down onto the higher mental plane by the monad. So if I was to go a little farther, let's see what I've got. Is it possible? Maybe that, yeah. Here is that line which goes to the center of the egoic lotus, and which is generated through ordinary occult meditation. Now, whether that is a dotted line or a solid line will depend on how much we have actually achieved in not only receiving energy from that level, but somehow changing our point of attention to such a degree that we are actually focused within that level, which Master DK strongly advises in regard to perfecting our meditative technique. It impressed me so much when I long ago read Letters on Occult Meditation, and saw that he was saying that we fail in our meditation because we cannot really focus within the causal body, you know, upon the higher mental plane. And I saw, well, this is a problem, and it's a problem which has to be rectified in our studies at meditation, of meditation, and our attempts thus to meditate. This magical work is begun in the magician's own life. So, you know, he makes of himself a new creation. He regenerates, transmutes, transforms, transfigures, the substance and the vehicles of his personality nature. So it's begun in his own life, extends to the world of the astral plane, and those who are working with the glamour meditations, we know that our work is with the beam of light, triple beam of light, projected onto the astral plane. We have a lot of work to do there. And from thence, when potent there, can be demonstrated upon the physical plane and upon the higher planes eventually. But, you know, it looks like our first work is in regard to, in relation to the astral plane. Then changes later can occur upon the physical plane, and still later he becomes a worker in magic upon the higher planes. Well, you know, we're, let's just say, we're beginners here. In another few hundred years, I think Master DK will reveal some of the practical formulas which are involved in working the practical white magic. On the other hand, he says, if we really study all of this carefully academically, we will be in a much better position to absorb that kind of instruction when it is given. So we may feel we are delayed by having to deal with the academic material, and we actually want to get in there and do something. I mean, one can hold off too long and just stay in academia, or one can plunge in too quickly and not have the academic foundation. Again, the noble middle path will be required of us. We shall therefore take a good deal of time over this rule, for it covers the immediate work and activity of the intelligent aspirant. And that is for whom he is writing, you know. So much of this kind of work is written for initiates of the first degree. He does tell us that's the case, certainly with esoteric psychology, I think. But he doesn't really say that when it comes to the rays and the initiations, which carry forward a kind of group work for the Aquarian Age, which produces the initiate group. It is the most important in the book from the standpoint of the average student. And he says, and look, let's consider ourselves, all of us, as average, because if we don't, we will be guilty of pride and separatism and so forth. So let's consider ourselves to be the average student. And this rule 8 is the most important in the book. Now, probably he would, you know, he knows the 15 rules of magic, and he could look ahead and have in his mind what he would say. And probably with that prognostication, he's still saying that from our point of view, the point of view of the average student of this book, this is the most important rule. It cannot be understood where there is no soul contact. Nor can the magical force of the soul work out in manifestation upon the physical plane until its meaning, till the meaning of its esoteric phrases has been somewhat wrought out in the inner experience of the magician. So requirements, you know, are soul contact and inner experience of that which the esoteric phrases of this rule suggest. Well, it's quite an adventure, you know. Some of us are older students, you know, and we've been with this a long time, and maybe we seized upon this book early in our work with the Bailey material. I know I did. And I'm always just getting more and more out of it as I carefully read. And that's what I'm trying to do with you in this kind of study group experiment. Carefully read and offer thoughts which may be useful when added to your own thoughts arising from your own reading and interpretation of the material. Most true aspirants, now there we go, remember true aspirant? Every true aspirant, i.e., initiates of the first degree, every true aspirant is an initiate of the first degree. Most true aspirants, most, are now at the midway spot. Well, what does he call it here, actually? The midway, at the point, he calls it the point where land and water meet. Now, the midway spot seems to involve air as well, etheric. So, midway spot, and does this mean the point where land and water meet, or the etheric area surrounding the pineal gland? Because there's a lot of drowning to be done at that point where land and water meet, okay. And can either drown and so make no further progress in this life. In a way, drowning has a technical meaning, and it can be fatal in a life, or it can mean just being overcome and engulfed by emotion. You know, the control the body of emotion, for the waves that rise upon the stormy seas of life engulf the swimmer, shut out the sun and render all plans futile. Go to page 473 of this book and you'll find 15 counsels which will make of you an adept if properly followed. There it is. Control the body of emotion, for the waves that rise upon the stormy seas of life engulf the swimmer, shut out the sun, and render all plans futile. So memorize those counsels and apply them, right? Okay. So he can drown and make no further progress in this life because overcome by emotion with all of its distortions and being cut off from the illumination of the mind held steady in the light. Or he can stand and so hold the ground gained, at least, you know, at least that, or become the true practicing magicians, efficient in white magic, third ray, seventh ray efficiency, which is based on love, because it's the white magic of the soul, and the soul is the love principle, animated by wisdom. Love wisdom is the factor connected with this second principle, and intelligently applied to form. So we have three choices. Go backwards. And this is a type of drowning, maybe not the technical type of drowning that kills you, you know, for that incarnation. Hold the ground gained, or go forward and become the true white magician. Right. We will therefore divide this rule into several parts. The most easily to study, the more easily to study it, and take them step by step. Master DK knows, you know, our assimilation process. Sometimes when I'm correlating all these things, you know, I know it's not ideal for the assimilation process, but at least I set out a picture of connections, which may be more sequentially studied piece by piece and bit by bit. The more easily to study it and take them up step by step so as to grasp their application to the average life of the probationary disciple. Now, who is the probationary disciple? Well, is he even the true aspirant? You know, the probationary disciple exists before the first initiation, but for those who are purists in assessment, you're still a probationary disciple until you're an accepted disciple. But on the other hand, we're always on probation. We're always being tested. And who is the disciple who is not being tested? So in a way, although the technical term applies to an early stage upon the path, no matter where we stand, we're all probationary disciples or probationary initiates who are necessarily disciples. So we want to grasp the various parts of this rule and their application to the average life of the probationary disciple. It's always wiser to underestimate one's accomplishments because, as he says, you know, the beginner is always more consciously conceited or just conceited. The beginner is always more conceited, overestimating himself. So we joke and say, subtract one, subtract two, and you estimate where you stand. So we want to gain the wise understanding of their wide implications. And implications, it's an interesting word. It's this word, implications, is a bridging, B-R-I-D, bridging connective, Mercurian, M-E-C-N, oh, M-E, okay, Mercurian word. That was my problem. Mercurian word. Making bridges between things, energies, sources that we did not know were connected. And when the connecting occurs, we see a much more unified picture. So these three divisions are, we have three divisions now, the response of the astral elementals and the subsequent consequent ebb and flow of the waters. And we say, to what are they responding? To a sound uttered forth by the magician, to the word of the soul, which is reinforcing the word of the magician. The dangers of the midway spot or point. Where land and water meet, he calls it, we have to watch out for spots and points, right? It's nature and the opportunity it affords and the place where magic is wrought. This is the true, it's the place where land and water meet, you know, and air and, the midway spot, which is neither dry nor wet, must provide the standing place whereon his feet are set. And that midway spot is involving the etheric brain and what some people call the cave. Perhaps overdoing the implications of that word, but definitely it is related to the cave of initiation. So many of the external symbols have to do with some sort of anatomically correct inner structure. So this midway spot, this is the true midway spot where magic is wrought. There is the place for magic to be wrought, where Water, land, and air meet. When water, land, and air meet, there is the place for magic to be wrought. When water, land, and air meet, there is the place for magic to be wrought. So, you know, watch his words carefully. Sometimes he's extremely precise, sometimes he's fluid. We will now study the first point, which is summed up for us in the words as follows. The Agnisurians respond to the sound, the waters ebb and flow. Well, Agnisurians are a type of, I think, unconscious deva, maybe having even more to do with the elemental life than with the conscious devic life. The situation might be stated in the following terse statements. I love the way he summarizes things, so we really get a handle on things and can be clear in our studies. The Agnisurians respond to the sound. The waters ebb and flow. And here are some terse statements, and maybe they will offer a degree of clarity to us. It's better to proceed with no rush. There is no rush, no hurry, and yet there is no time to lose. The rules already studied convey the truth anent the magician. Number one, the soul has communicated with its instrument in the three worlds. There is a high consciousness up there, you know, and it's aware of its extension and its supervisee, which is what we are as a personality. The man on the physical plane recognizes the contact. How will you recognize it? Different ways, perhaps. Maybe a sensation, maybe a some sort of feeling, maybe certain kinds of thoughts. The man on the physical plane recognizes the contact, and the light in the head shines forth, sometimes recognized and sometimes unrecognized by the aspirant. One can be intuitive, we are told, and still not recognize, recognize the phenomenon of the in the light of the head. So it depends on the quality of the brain cells, he tells us. So these are terse, they are direct, they go in a way, looks like rule after rule. The soul sounds forth its note. A thought form is created in consonance with the united meditation of the soul and the man, his instrument. So it's a, you know, it's a dual meditation which creates something, creates a thought form to be materialized eventually. This, number four, this thought form embodying the will of the ego or soul, cooperating with the personality, takes to itself a triple form constituted of the matter of all three planes and vitalized through the activity and by the emanations of the heart, throat, and ajna centers. We remember this is called heart, throat, and eye. Let's make sure I've done that right. Heart, throat, and eye allied for triple service. Okay. Thus are the heart, throat, and eye allied for triple service. Okay. So the ajna, the heart, throat, and eye of the white magician are engaged, and the soul also in conjunction with its instrument. It is as if the soul is using the heart, throat, and eye. We remember the motives, the condition of the waters, the mantrams which protect the eye under steady gaze, which controls. It's kind of a 2, 3, and a 1, with the eye as the first ray, throat as the third ray, heart as the second. The personality sheaths, each with its own individual life, feel they are losing their power. And the battle between the forces of matter, let us say, of the personality, and the force of the soul is violently renewed. What can we call it? Last ditch stand of the personality. Because this time, you know, it's really going to have to relinquish its control. It is driven forth and loses its master. How is it put? The devas of the lower four feel the force. When the eye opens, they are driven forth and lose their master. The previous master was the personality. Now a higher center is involved as the directing force. It will be the man as the soul in incarnation, and the soul through the man, through the consciousness projected into the personality areas. This is a battle that must be fought out on the astral plane, and we'll decide three things. So, you know, note those disciples who are battling. Maybe every disciple is battling. I think the battle goes on and on, given the fourth ray monadic nature, or at least the focus of the human monad upon the fourth or buddhic plane. When it comes to what is the monadic ray of man, he does proceed by destruction. You kind of wonder about the first ray and eventually the second ray soul and fourth ray personality, but now the fourth ray soul, probably, and the fifth ray personality. Anyway, man is a destroyer in many ways. He is associated with Vulcan. Vulcan is an interesting planet in that it represents the constructive aspect of the first ray, as well as the power, hammer-like, to destroy. So this battle must be fought out on the astral plane, and we'll decide three things. Whether the soul will, in any one life, or some life holds the critical stage, if we could only recognize that, be the dominant factor and the personality from henceforth be the servant of the soul. We're ending the ancient authority of the personality, you know. I pointed that out in the rays and the initiations, where you have freedom from this, freedom from that, and the third point, freedom from the ancient authority of the personality. So whether the soul will be the dominant factor and the personality from henceforth, the servant of the soul. If we can serve the soul, we can serve the Christ. If we can serve the Christ, we can serve the soul. Whether the astral plane is no longer the plane of illusion, but can become the field of service, as is the case for seed groups, number 2, the trained observers who involve the solar plexus center, and number 8, anyway, which is the divine, or the psychologist, the new age psychologist. Whoa, I forgot one, and that is number 6, the workers in the field of religion. So instead of being baffled and confused and misled and pursuing desires that lead nowhere, we can use that vehicle to express the energy of love and high desire and aspiration, and we can help other people eliminate their tendency to become ensnared in the illusions of the astral plane, the glamours and illusions of the astral plane. And onward, whether a man can become an active cooperator with the hierarchy, able to create and wield mental matter. That's where they work, you know, with regard to us, the masters work upon the plane of mind, and so work out the purposes of the universal mind. Let's say the mind of the solar logos or the high cosmic mind of our planetary logos, which are prompted by boundless and infinite love and are the expressions of the one life. Ah, it's a beautiful phrase. So even the, well, universal mind, you know, we have reflections of it down here on the cosmic physical plane, but the real universal mind has to find its place on the cosmic planes and on ever higher areas of the cosmic planes. We cannot imagine that the mind of a being that expresses through a galaxy is on the same sort of cosmic plane as the mind of a planetary logos or the mind of a solar logos. Just imagine there's a trillion something solar logoi through which one of these galactic beings is expressing. So there are ever higher, not ever higher, but there are higher and higher cosmic planes, super, 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 you know, until we reach what is called by the Tibetan the 10 dimensions of cosmos. Cosmos being, after all, at least in my view, a finitude and not an infinitude. The only infinitude is the absolute deity, which is the sort of self-observation of absoluteness. But again, you know, that gets into unverifiable factors. So these are the terse statements. Are there others? Well, he certainly, you know, I'm tempted to just kind of say, okay, let's really make these yellow. Let's really highlight all this. Okay. Okay, the situation might be stated as follows. And I'm going to have to perhaps just no color. All right. Now we go on a little bit. Looks like I have decided on the 1 hour option. So we've been presented in certain terse statements the, and from another point of view, the meaning of the first six or seven rules, I think. And he says, this is the crux of the entire situation. And when a man has mastered the forces opposed to him, we might say opposed to his ascent in points of tension, he is ready for the second initiation, which marks the release of the soul from the prison of the astral body. And so many of Master DK's students stood at this point, whether in this life, the next, or the next. How long does it take to, between the first and second, we've discussed it. Sometimes it seems like many lives. Sometimes it seems that even one life will do. Initiation Humanist Soul, page 120. So he, you know, in a way, he's kind of training us to deal with the astral body here and with the possibility of preparing for the second initiation. Henceforth, the soul will use the astral body and will mold desire into line with divine purpose and, you know, before that, divine plan. It's different than having a battle raging all the time. Now, when you have a Scorpio incarnation being born either in Scorpio or under Scorpio, rising sign, and when Mars is prominent, when Pluto is prominent, and, you know, many squares in the chart and oppositions and so forth, then the battle will rage. And the resolution of every battle into harmony is followed by another battle, at least for those who are members of this fourth grade of hierarchy, which we are. Just, you know, pause and think. You know, you don't have to look at Star Wars and a bar experience in Star Wars to realize that there are other types of beings in our solar system and in our cosmos. They look pretty strange there, quite amusing, but here we are all together embodying or embodied, consciousness embodied in this type of form, and we might be in an entirely different type of form, but somehow in our descent into increasing individuality and particularity, this planet, this creative hierarchy and so forth, have been our choice. And we look as we do and we present as we do because of the choices we have made, either as a kingdom, a family, or maybe as individuals on our descent from identification as the one. It is of value for the student to know where he stands and what his particular problem is. You know, why be blind? We can't really solve anything if we are in a state of blindness. So, you know, be clear and brave and face what we are, at least relatively. What we are in essence, of course, is pure being, you know, which cannot really be described as anything in relative terms. The average man is learning the control of the physical body, which is, you know, achieved at the first degree, more or less. The control of the physical body and the organizing of his physical plane life. So, goodness, don't we see? We see in this how important is the seventh ray. The student on the probationary path is learning a similar relation, a lesson in relation to his astral body, its focus and its desires. So we are on the path of probation. Let's see, path of probation. We are mastering our emotional body. EMB. Let's get that one. Should have had it. Okay. We're mastering our emotional body, our etheric body. The student on the path of accepted discipleship, and note, he does not put the term discipleship between the path of probation and accepted discipleship. So, you know, pretty well, he's saying you're on probation to be accepted until you are accepted. The student on the path of accepted discipleship has to demonstrate his control and begin to demonstrate the mind nature, discipline the mind nature, and so function consciously in the mental body. All right. That's what it takes. And, you know, on the path of discipleship, true discipleship, perhaps Mercury and Saturn, two very strongly mental planets, having a lot of third ray and, you know, to a degree, fifth ray concreteness. They are planets of accepted discipleship or of discipleship. And the work of the initiate and the adept grows out of these achievements and involves, you know, work within the cosmic, etheric realm of the abstract mind and the intuition and probably the spiritual will. I mean, when we look at a mind, and there, you know, there are a number of them. Einstein doesn't stand alone, but when we look at a mind like that, even though, well, he seemed to have this belief in God, you know, and Spinoza, who was a God-inspired man, was a great inspiration to Einstein. I have a little book where he writes the introduction. It's the Spinoza Dictionary. But we've got to say that such a mind was initiated. You know, what is the level of initiation? It's along the third ray line and fifth ray line. What is that level of initiation? We don't know, but it has to be quite high because the intuition revealing the workings of the mind of God in the most significant manner was activated. Without that intuition coming, you know, or help coming from his Piscean nature and his Cancerian nature with Neptune bringing him in attunement with the Buddhic plane, he wouldn't have been able to capture the visions and the thoughts which made his presentation so unique, at least at the time. And many great scientists still puzzle. How did he come up with that? How did he come up with all that? Well, it was imagination to a degree, imagination being stronger than intellect. So really, you know, buddhi-manas was something that a mind like Einstein used. Okay. Now the battle, we're involved in it. The battle is spread over quite a series of lives, but in some one life it becomes critical. And you know, you can ask yourself, is this a scorpionic life? Because that's when you really suffer, and that's when you really have to decide, you know, you must decide. Anyway, the final stand is made, and Arjuna triumphs. Let's see if I can do this. Arjuna triumphs, but only by letting Krishna assume the reins of control. In other words, we learn to be guided by the soul within the egoic lotus. And maybe for some, by the soul within the cosmic ethers. I still have to kind of work that out. You know, the true position of the solar angel is difficult to determine. And since it has already been to the cosmic astral plane, pursuing the path to Sirius, the fourth path, it would have worked its way through the higher cosmic ethers and could ostensibly position itself through point of tension on any one of them. But the chart that we have shows it in its fuller nature, dwelling upon the Buddhic plane, and thus a heart of fiery love. So he lets Krishna assume the reins of control. And have we done that? Have we allowed Krishna, our soul, another name for the Christ principle, to assume control? And do we immediately obey the inner impulses of the soul? You know, one of those demands, inquire the way, obey the inner impulses of the soul, pay no attention to worldly wisdom, and set an example. Those are roughly those four demands at the end of the book. Krishna assumes the reins of control, and by learning mind control and by revelation of the form of God. I mean, what is this, the mystic might say? Seeing all things as within God. By distinguishing between the soul and form, it's done on the fourth plane of discrimination, the fourth subplane of the mental plane, and by a vision of the perfection of the glory which can radiate from the forms indwelt by God. So radiatory Vulcan, radiatory Vulcan is involved because it burnishes the shield of Mars, as we're told, that, you know, bringing the light value out of the normal Martian personality. He learns to choose the way of light and to see his form and all forms as custodians of the light, seeing all things within a greater light, right? As within a greater light. And do we, you know. So he buckles down to the work of making the astral body simply a reflector of that light. You know, when we send that beam forth, it's a beam of discovery, it's a beam of revelation, it's a beam of destruction. When we send it forth, we are interested in increasing the light reflecting value of the astral body. That's in the glamour meditation. So he buckles down to the work of making the astral body simply a reflector of that light. And by the quelling of desire, especially that kind of desire that is aimed towards the phenomenal worlds, through the subjugation of the Agnisurians, who constitute his astral body and are the living substance of the astral plane. And here, that I think that's a very good definition of Agnisurians. Remember, there are Agnisurians in relation to the Buddhic plane, and there's probably whole hierarchies of Agnisurians, you know. So some of them are maybe very substantial in a way, and others maybe are higher in their hierarchy as beings. The subjugation of the Agnisurians who constitute his astral body and are the living substance of the astral plane. I like that because we need good definitions here of the kinds of beings that we encounter. He learns to function as an adept on that plane, to pierce through its illusion and to see life true instead of through a glass darkly, or, distorted. Okay. All right. Well, we'll go on. You know, not this moment. It says, speaking symbolically, the substance of the astral plane is animated by three types of divine force, which, when brought together, produce the great illusion. Even the universe itself is compared to absoluteness, the great illusion. But this is the end of Treatise on White Magic, video commentary number 8, rules for the astral plane, rule 8, and we have what's called 8.1, and we are on some page, rather, here, aren't we? We're on page 238. And then we will begin here next time, and whenever that is, beginning of a Treatise on White Magic, commentary number 9. And this will be 8.2, rule 8 and the second part of it. Well, you know, I'm trying to work in a somewhat contemplative manner here. going along fairly slowly to let the ideas sink in. Sometimes I speak too fast, I know, and I've been thinking about that and how to slow things down so assimilation is a greater possibility. So we'll go on. Remember that all of this is up on YouTube and Moria Federation Esoteric Education. There'll be a place where you can see all these rules as Program 1, Program 2, etc. In the work of the of the rules for the astral plane. So this is rules for the astral plane, rule 7, and maybe this is like program 8.1 and then program 8.2, or maybe this is program number 9. I just have to figure that out. Maybe it's just rule 8.2, and we'll do it that way. And we'll put down program number 8 and program number 9. Program number 8 and program number 9. Okay, friends, so we continue our studies. We continue our assimilation of these matters. And we make the teaching a part of our deep understanding so we can apply it in a true way and not just be, you know, speaking words. All right, many blessings, and we'll talk to you when I can and before long. Take care.